Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Hey, hey, folks. Welcome to the Man of Steel podcast. Guess who? Yes, it's me, Michael Steele. Now, you can find us, as we always say, on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn, or wherever you get your podcast kicks. You got to go there to listen. So download and listen and have fun. And we're going to have a load of fun today as we all kind of, you know, get ready to stuff our bellies with some turkey. And then, of course, after we've stuffed our belly with some turkey, we want to sit back and relax, and this is why we got the perfect person to have that conversation. It is the one and only, the incomparable Donna Edwards, who served as a congresswoman from my home state. Actually, she was my congresswoman from Maryland's 4th Congressional District from 2008 to 2017. During the midterm elections, she worked with healthcarevoter.org, which I understand you guys did some great work making sure healthcare was first and foremost in the minds of voters out there. So, hey, Donna, welcome to the Man of Steel podcast. Great to have you.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
Absolutely. So, needless to say, we had the elections, and we'll talk a little bit about that. But the post-election noise, I guess you could call it, has been as exciting as everything that led up to and involved in Election Day. You've got the president now talking about, or at least we've discovered, the president was trying to prosecute Hillary Clinton and James Comey. You've got Nancy Pelosi and her battle for the speakership. What's your assessment of what's going on in this period? Are we seeing some kind of transition that's happening, or what?
I don't know. I think it's hard to measure. You know, I was thinking, first of all, the election's not really over because there's still ballots being counted
right. In
a couple of places. This is like the election that will never end. but, you know, at the end of the day, I mean, you know, it was interesting because when you look at the results, Democrats are set to pick up maybe 40 seats in the House of Representatives.
Close to it, yeah.
But you would think, Michael, that would mean that Democrats would also, some of them would not be trying to overthrow their speaker and their leadership that brought on this great victory. And so it's just kind of a weird moment. I think Nancy Pelosi is going to survive. What do you think?
Yeah, I think she will. I've been on the record as someone who has opposed Nancy Pelosi for a long time and have been in the trenches against her. I know how formidable she is. I know how incredibly competent and capable she is, not just as a leader, but as a strategist. I watched her whipsaw that delegation, that caucus, in 2010 without Republican votes to get the Affordable Care Act passed, even with reticence and resistance to some degree from the White House. And she got it done. So I've always been kind of surprised on two fronts. One, the Democrats don't appreciate what she did, and they're sort of hung up on this ageism thing and, you know, new leadership. Well, there is no new leadership that's emerged in the Democratic Party to step in and be speaker in the age of Trump. There just isn't. She's, in my view, the only one who can do that. And the second thing, which is really weird for me, Donna, I find myself defending Nancy Pelosi after I defeated her, which is the strangest thing. I'm like, wait a minute. I should be up here saying, oh, my God, no, people, no, we don't want Nancy Pelosi. But I respect what she's done. And I'm just surprised that Democrats have been so down on her. I don't know what they think is going to happen with someone else other than Nancy Pelosi. Trump will eat them for dinner, snacks, and everything else.
And here's the thing, there's not going to be anybody other than Nancy Pelosi. And what's interesting to me, we know this, Michael, because we're Marylanders, right?
Right.
People think she's from San Francisco. She's really from Baltimore.
That's right.
And and she has, you know, she does the bare knuckles politics of all of it, moving the chess pieces around, solidifying her leadership and keeping her caucus in check, which is really necessary in the era of Trump. And you know, the polls have come out and show actually that Nancy Pelosi has overwhelming support among Democrats. And I found it fascinating that some of the rabble rousers, and there's really only a couple of handful of them, but they've gone back to their districts and they have gotten an earful about people who don't want Nancy Pelosi to go anywhere. And I just kind of think Nancy Pelosi did not earn her speakership and her leadership by having it handed over to her. She worked for it. And so I'm kind of amazed by these young leaders who say, we want Nancy to hand over the gavel to someone else. Well, that's not how it's going to happen. Somebody's got to get into that caucus and demonstrate that they have the support of the caucus and that they have done the things that it takes to be a leader and a speaker. And they haven't done that yet. And when Nancy Pelosi steps aside, that's inevitable, Michael, isn't it? All of that leadership team, it's inevitable.
Well, you have a piece up in the Washington Post, and I would recommend people to read it because you have a very interesting approach to this, which in one sense is rooted in the same space as some of these, you know, never Pelosi people are. But you go on and say, you know, I was in no mood to support Pelosi and the corporate Democrats she represented when you were elected. First elected to Congress. I was wrong. As soon as I was sworn in by the first female speaker, I began to appreciate the power of that role and her understanding of it. Once the election was over, it was over. I was her member. First, she wanted to know my aspirations and how she could help me achieve them. Then I watched as she paid close attention to the individual needs of the Democrats, especially those from vulnerable districts. That's the part of this that I don't think the Alexandria Ocasio-Cortezes and others really get. And even though Alexandria's kind of backed off of it in recent days, this fervor that was out there in the beginning was really, I think, kind of phony because it was really attached to nothing because there was no one who had emerged that they could, you know, rally around. And you as a new member back in the day, you were skeptical. You weren't part of the corporate Democrats. I remember your race. You took down one of the big corporate Democratic players in Al Wynn, who was, you guys say corporate, we say establishment on the Republican side. But he was the establishment order, if you will. And I remember your race and thinking, oh, hell. Because your first bite at that apple didn't go so well. But you got it on the second. And that is... You know, coming in the way you did, you aren't beholden to the system like a lot of these folks are. But you realize what was at stake here and the speaker who was willing to listen to you.
I did. And I wanted, and you know, look, my politics and Nancy Pelosi's politics are very similar, quite frankly. And that's why I think most of this opposition, actually all of it, if you start looking at the letter of the people who said that they, you know, oppose her, is not coming from the progressive wing of the party. It's actually coming from the centrists and some moderates and
right.
from a lot of incumbents who are in safe Democratic districts. So I think they're going to find themselves in trouble come 2020. But my experience was you came into the caucus and when you're in a safe district, you know this, it's the same is true in the Republican Party. You're in a safe district. Your job is to go out there and to help people who are not and to bring in more and to help raise money for the party to make that happen. And I recognized that role and I learned from Nancy. I learned so much from her and I rose up in the ranks of the DCCC, the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, the campaign arm. And then she helped me to rise up in leadership. And so I sat in that small leadership circle as a co-chair of one of her committees, the Steering and Policy Committee, and I got to see up close and personal how it is that she worked, how she worked for the interests of the caucus, but also how she worked Republicans in the House, Republicans in the Senate, worked at a Democratic White House and a Republican White House. I got to see that. And so, you know, I'm a big fan of hers. Is she going to stay forever? No, that, as I said, is inevitable. But some of these folks need to, you know, put the meat behind the bones and get out there and work for their own leadership. And right now, frankly, we just need her. We need her skill and her talent to set the table for 2020. And then there might be more decisions after that. But I'm a big fan, and I think Democrats would be making a huge mistake. And as I say, don't blow it. I mean, can you imagine, Michael, you come off the heels of this really, really big historic win.
Right.
And then instead of talking about health care and a legislative agenda, we're talking about a leadership fight. It doesn't make any sense.
Well, it doesn't, but it's typical of political operations and operatives who, you know, have axes to gore and axes to grind and all the other crap that goes into it. I remember doing a hit on MSNBC, and I think it was on Meet the Press, and I forget the Democrat who was on the panel with us, but they were kind of whining and gnashing up their teeth and wringing their hands. And I just looked at them and said, would you stop complaining? You won. I mean, just enjoy the moment. You know, you're sitting up and going, oh my God, you know, this didn't happen and that didn't happen. I'm like, wait a minute. You got more seats than the other guy. So we call that a win. Take it and go with it. You know, just enjoy
it's
the moment.
So amazing. Yeah, totally amazing. And, you know, what's really interesting, and we should get to talk about it, is this election was about health care. It was about protecting people with pre-existing conditions. It was about making sure that more people get protected under the Affordable Care Act, and you fix some of the problems and, you know, try to stabilize some of these marketplaces. That's the stuff that we should be talking about right now.
Yeah, I agree with that to a degree, up to a point. I don't know if this was so much about health care. Yes, Democratic candidates, that was their number one talking point. That was their opening conversation and their closing conversation with voters. But I think I'm curious what you think about this. My suspicion sort of rides along the lines of this was less a policy oriented, you know, big policy questions on healthcare and foreign relations and immigration and all of that. Trump used immigration as a cudgel to sort of beat into submission Republicans who were otherwise worried about losing the Senate. Democrats used health care as a wedge, quite honestly, to widen the gap between Republicans and Democrats in the sense that certain Republicans who needed a reason to vote for a Democrat had one. You guys gave us a good reason, gave Republicans rather a good reason on a policy side to go vote. But I still think beneath all of that was two questions that I think voters were really kind of starting to answer. And that is, one, what kind of country do you want in this age of Trump? And two, what kind of leaders do you want to lead it? Which is what made the races for the U.S. Senate in Texas, the governor's races in Georgia and Florida, the U.S. Senate and seat in Tennessee, for example, what made those very different races somewhat similar? Because voters were wrangling and wrestling over those questions. I would dare say healthcare was not a reason to vote for Beto O'Rourke or Stacey Abrams. But it was also about, or not just the reason, but it was also about the leadership. Beto O'Rourke brought something that was fresh and new. I mean, he was the white Obama, as one Democrat told me, which I thought was rather amusing in so many ways. So, you know, you had this very interesting dynamic in that regard, which I thought made the difference to the positive. Certainly swung independent voters in the way of the Democrats.
Well, I mean, I would say that, first of all, in all the exit polling, healthcare, you ask people what's the most important issue. Healthcare was the number one issue in this election.
Right.
Now, in individual sort of congressional races, they could focus on those things. The national was about Donald Trump. He said it, I'm on the ballot.
Right.
He said over and over again, I'm on the ballot. And a lot of people, suburban voters, college voters, women voters, certainly minority voters, said, you're on the ballot, we don't like that so much. And they voted the other direction. Now, I think these close races in Texas, in Georgia, in Florida, Tennessee, these races, I think you had candidates who were so inspirational that they got people who ordinarily would have sat this one out to come up, and that made it close in states where you wouldn't have assumed that it would be a close race. I think that's good. And the challenge for Democrats in 2020 is going to be, how do we appeal to, how do we talk to those voters so that they don't sit home in the 2020 election, and that we, you know, we keep them on board. And that's going to be a challenge of figuring out, one, what a message is and how we appeal to them. But it also means making sure that they see somebody that it speaks to them. And I don't know that we have quite figured out that formula yet.
Yeah, I agree. I keep saying to, my Democratic friends, and there are very few of them like yourself who really understand what at stake over the next 2 years, the pathway that should be taken versus the pathway that extreme voices will want the party to take in order to maximize opportunity in 2020. With Trump at the top of the ballot, the Senate in play for Democrats, it's not a good table for Republicans in 2020 on the Senate side. The House will be up again, but the likelihood of losing it is not that high. So you can hold and maybe even expand your numbers there. But it all depends on the kind of case you make to the American people. And I think when I look at our own state with Ben Jealous' race versus Larry Hogan, a center-right Republican, when I look at Florida with Gillum and Georgia with Stacey Abrams, just how far do you think that progressive argument is going to go with the American people? I'm sure you will disagree with me. I think the country is a center-right country. You probably think it's more of a center-left country. And that's the sweet spot where we kind of battle. I don't know if you can go into certainly the Rust Belt states and other places like that and make a case for free. Because those are pragmatic folks, and their first question is, well, who's going to pay for free? Because somebody's got to pay for free. And, you know, they already do not have the benefit of the tax cuts in middle-class America. And just as an asterisk for the audience, so if you don't believe me, why was the president going out saying, I'm going to give everybody a middle-class tax cut? Oh, I thought you just did that last year. Wait a minute, hold up. No, you mean, who was that tax cut for if it wasn't the middle class? So let's be honest about where we are in this thing. And I think for Democrats, that's going to be an interesting challenge, how progressives like yourself marinate an argument that will be, you know, sellable in the Southwest, the Rust Belt, and elsewhere.
Look, I think that if you look at, let's take three states, Georgia, Florida, and Texas, there are some different dynamics going on in each of those states, so they're not the same. In Georgia, I don't think overlook the fact that Brian Kemp, the governor-elect, really did wretched things as Secretary of State to keep a lot of minority voters in particular off the, right, out of the voting booth.
Right.
And I think that that's a problem. So that's a whole set of voters, the 1.6 million that were purged, the 53,000
that were held aside.
So that's a different thing. In Florida, interestingly, is in this last election, the law passed that allows felons to register to vote, ex-felons to register to vote now. And I think that that's going to make a huge difference. There are a lot of people right now going in doing voter registration of something that passed rather overwhelmingly on that ballot. And so that will be it. Florida will be something that we all still have to figure out. And of course, Florida is a different animal itself in any election. And then in Texas, I think Beto appeals to a whole set of folks in this, you know, in a magical kind of way because of the way he talked about issues, because he was so positive, that makes Texas an interesting study. And who knows, Beto might end up on a statewide ballot running for the Senate. Stacey Abrams might end up on a statewide ballot running for Senate. And so there are a lot of prospects out there. But I think that you are right in saying, if you look at, Democrats made gains in Wisconsin, in Pennsylvania. They made gains in Michigan. And I think that's really important. But the question is holding them. And I think where the House becomes really important is the House begins to set the message and legislative agenda for Democrats.
Right.
It's true they may not pass legislation that goes to the Senate and then goes to the president, but they can say this is the framework. This is what we would do if we were in power. And it can be around those issues that are important to people. Let's start building some roads and bridges and creating jobs, those middle class jobs that you talked about. Fixing the healthcare system. I think there are a number of things that they can do that really appeal to that Rust Belt without abandoning values and principles. And I think those are things that progressives can grab onto, as well as that sweet spot independent.
It's going to be fascinating to watch. You know, I think parties have a propensity to misjudge election success. I witnessed that after the 2010 election, where a lot of cockeyed folks who had nothing to do with the victory that we fought for and attained suddenly claimed credit for it and all of a sudden wanted to run things. And, well, here we are 6 years later after 2012, and we don't run much anymore. So the Democrats
Well, there's the beauty of a Nancy Pelosi as a speaker. I think that is what will make a difference, because I think she will, you know, read that everybody in that caucus can't go along with everything.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. And again, you know, how these young progressives coming into the fold manage their responsibilities. Here's the question for everybody out there. Do they change the House, particularly these 100 women who are coming into the Congress, the most we've ever had? Yes, the majority of them are the vast majority of them are Democrats. you know, that's just ridiculous that Republicans didn't even come to play in this respect. But that's another conversation. So you have all of this energy. Certainly, you can link it back to the march after the inauguration in 2017 rather. So there are bridges, there are connections. Now the question becomes, Donna, and you know this better than most, does the institution change them or do they change the institution? Because
I think I think they change the institution. But Michael, here's the thing. Once you get in, you realize that the institution is really big.
Big building.
Right. It doesn't move like a tornado moves through.
Right.
It moves much more slowly.
Right.
And so I think that they will figure out ways that they can begin to have an impact. You know, I'll just give one little example. So Congresswoman-elect Ilhan Omar is coming in from Minnesota. Well, for years, since before the Civil War, 1837, there's been a rule in place that you cannot wear hats or headgear onto the floor of the House. Well, she wears a hijab. She's a Muslim woman. And so the rule has actually been changed so that she is able to wear her religious garb onto the House floor. And so there are things like that that will be slowly noticeable.
Right.
I remember when John Boehner took over, and there were more women then than had ever been in. And women had been clamoring for a bathroom off of the side of the floor of the House so they wouldn't have to run across the Capitol just to use the facilities. Men didn't have to do that. And so John Boehner comes in as speaker. The women go to him. And the next thing you know, there's a bathroom off the floor of the House for the women.
Right.
And so it is an institution that can change. The question is whether a lot of these women, and especially the millennial women, will have the patience for that. And I would urge them to have the patience for it.
Yeah, it's going to require a lot of patience, because I think as much as we have this energy behind women, and it's a real raw energy, and it's so good to see, the institution is something very different. It is still very much male oriented, even with a female speaker. There's still a lot of issues, and I'll just give you a good example of it, and that's the sexual harassment issue. Slowly the Congress has still moved on this issue. Now we have the Senate finally talking about, yeah, we'll get something done in this transition period. We'll get a bill passed. Well, damn, that's been 2 years since this thing blew up. 3 years if you go back to the Access Hollywood tape. You know, it is of itself anchored in a time and place that it still wants to hold on to. I'm going to be watching to see how women unleash the Kraken, as they say. And you referred to a tornado. I refer to the Kraken, just kind of wrap their arms around and just sort of break the thing open, you know? It's because it's going to have to happen. So speaking of breaking things open, you had this week a revelation by the New York Times, actually just really popped recently in the last 24, 36 hours or so, where the president basically told his White House counsel, McGahn, this man is amazing, told Don McGahn, look, I want you to order the Justice Department to prosecute two people for me, James Comey and Hillary Clinton. Now, can you do that? And fortunately for McGahn, he was like, Mr. President, no. I don't have the authority to do it. You don't have the authority to do it, to order the prosecution of anyone. What the hell is wrong with this president that he thinks that he can just command his general counsel to go and order the prosecution of private citizens because he doesn't like what they did when they were in public office? Oh, and what they did was, oh, they just, you know, said nasty things about him.
Well, I mean, you know, it really is extraordinary. And I know we chuckle about this because it's like, could that really have happened? But I think that, I mean, this is really beyond the pale. I mean, this is the kind of thing that's done in, you know, the Philippines right now under Duterte, or, you know, in Turkey under Erdogan, where, you know, Putin in Russia, where your political enemies then become real, you know, sort of enemies, and you pursue. Thing is that right now, Don McGahn is gone.
Right.
He's no longer the White House. I mean, there are so many players who are gone now who were providing some kind of check on the president. The president wouldn't take his word, and so McGahn went and got a memo drafted, a legal memo to say, you see, you can't do it because you would be impeached. I mean, impeached, they're the ones who were using that word. Forget whether the House or the Senate is going to use the I word. McGahn was using it with him. It really is an extraordinary departure and a really frightening one.
No, it is. What bothers me about it is just the total ignorance and arrogance, which, folks, you know, is a dangerous combination when someone is both ignorant and arrogant. That he would think that he could just go and tell Don McGahn to have the Justice Department prosecute people. On what grounds? On what grounds would they possibly be prosecuted? And it's just this whole sense of this administration is in a different space, and I think a dangerous one, ultimately. For me, hate spending my time talking about all the crazy that comes out of the administration. I'd rather be talking about good, positive, solid Republican policies and initiatives and programs that we think will empower people and get into a fight. Having you on the podcast to, you know, have a knockdown drag out over the, you know, the subtleties of a bill, or the possibilities of, you know, this form of healthcare package versus that healthcare package. Instead, we find ourselves in this season of Thanksgiving questioning who we are as Americans. A lot of Americans are concerned about, you know, what we should be thankful for when we have a president who just, you know, again, goes out and decides to side with the Saudis in the killing Khashoggi, Jamal Khashoggi, and basically says, well, it is what it is. And so all the things that have kind of defined who we are as a nation has now come not just under scrutiny, but under assault in so many ways. And I just think it's frustrating for a lot of folks like me and a lot of Americans who sit back and go, this is not the space we want to be in. Can you just get off the Twitter crack for just a moment and get into a rehab program and actually be president for once in the 4 years that you have the job? But, you know, we'll see.
Well, you know, Michael, I've actually been thinking about starting a therapy group for Republicans who are like you, because I'm feeling for you, buddy. I'm really feeling for you, because I actually would like to have that kind of like real policy policy debate, because I'm convinced our policies will win. It would be great to have the exchange.
Right.
You know, I thought on the same day that the story broke about McGahn, of course, the president's outrageous statement about the brutal murder and chopping up,
yep,
butchering of Jamal Khashoggi, and the president is kowtowing to the Saudis. And the United States holds all the leverage in that relationship. And I don't understand why we're not saying we're not going to be dealing with anything until you find one of the royals who can be your next in line, because we're not dealing with Mohammed bin Salman.
What can the Congress do, House or Senate, to put pressure on the president in this regard?
They could delay the arms sale. The Congress and the appropriations process and stuff. Of course, they've got the Magnitsky Act that's gone into effect, but they could demand that be applied to MBS, going along with the CIA's conclusion. I would urge the House, when it comes in January, to hold an immediate House-wide briefing, classified briefing from the CIA, so that all the members of Congress are on the same page about what happened.
Right.
Because the president is trying to spin this in a way that doesn't exist. And he was disparaging Jamal Khashoggi. It was almost like it was the talking points of the Saudis, only we knew it was really the president because it had all those exclamation marks in it.
Right. Right. Because nothing emphasizes your point more than an exclamation point, right? It just does. Yeah, the Khashoggi thing to me is very disturbing, because I go back to the president's initial tweet when this story first broke, and there were questions raised about his hesitancy or reticence to actually condemn the killing of Mr. Khashoggi. And the president made reference to the fact that he had no financial interests in Saudi Arabia. And that, to me, I focused on the word "in," because I think the truth of it is he has financial interests with the Saudis, and that doesn't necessarily mean he's building, you know, Trump Saudi in you know, someplace in a desert in Saudi Arabia. It means, though, that maybe there's financing that the Russians can no longer provide that the Saudis are now providing Jared Kushner and other enterprises related to Trump that need to be protected. I just think that I've always said with this administration, and I'm glad to see that the Mueller team really kind of did this, is follow the money. Because if you want to know where the dirt is, follow the money. And I think this is a good example where our policies, our foreign and domestic policy, in addition to our sort of, you know, definition of who we are as a country and as people, is all determined by whether or not the president has a financial interest or deal in place with those who come under scrutiny. And that, to me, should be disturbing to a lot of people.
Well, and I think when I listened to the president's press conference as he was heading on Marine One, he must have said maybe three or four times, "I have no financial interest." And to me, Al does protest too much.
Right.
And I think the only way that we're going to see that, and I do think, you know, having Elijah Cummings as the incoming chair of the Oversight Government Oversight Reform Committee, we're going to see the president's tax returns and really try to see what his financial interests are and are not with Saudi Arabia, with Russia, with, you know, any number of players, because I just don't believe it. And we certainly know Jared Kushner has financial interests in and with Saudi Arabia. And I think you're right to point to that preposition, because it was an interesting use of a preposition and an intentional use of a preposition. So there is some there.
Right.
But what worries me is that the president basically said, if you have any financial dealings, you know, maybe we're selling you some helicopters or an F-15 or an F-35, that you can go around and kill journalists, but we won't mind as long as you keep buying defense items. And I think that is very problematic. And I saw a statement by the Committee to Protect Journalists, and I think it's all very, very deeply troubling. And it speaks to our values. Like, who are we? This was a U.S. resident who worked for a United States company who was murdered in Turkey.
Yeah.
And it just really speaks to our value. You know, every year, Michael, the State Department issues a human rights report, and it goes through every country and points to their human rights violations. It only makes me wonder what those statements are going to be for 2018.
Yeah, that's a very good point. But, you know, Donald Trump won't care because,
He already said he doesn't care about human rights.
Yeah, he doesn't care about human rights. It's made up. It's fake. It's fiction, you know. It's like that caravan's coming up from the South. Have you heard the word caravan mentioned, by the way, since November 7th? Has anybody heard that word mentioned by anyone in this administration, including the president? That would be no.
No. And I mean, you know, you heard what he said about the service members who are down there, you know, rolling out wire on the border for people who aren't coming across the border.
Right.
Oh, you know, don't worry about them having Thanksgiving with their families.
Right.
Oh, my gosh.
I know.
So you know, and I'm a military. I've come from a military family, Michael.
Oh, I know.
And so it just angers me. It angers me, the use of the military as a political prop.
Yeah, it's a pain. It is definitely a pain to hear the president talk about these things this way, and that include the conversation, the attack on retired Admiral McGraven. Because the admiral said something about the president didn't like, as a private citizen, by the way. And it's just one of those things. And just for the record, no, he was not on Hillary Clinton's short list. You know, it's just made up. But the part that bothered me about that story was the way the RNC responded in supporting the attack on a former member of the military.
Yeah.
You know, from the party that is so rah-rah military, that's so red, white, and blue, so USA, USA. Because an admiral expressed his First Amendment right as a private citizen during the presidential campaign that said something critical of the president, and the president didn't like it, that the president now said, well, maybe he could have gotten Bin Laden faster, you know, and they go, yeah, what he said. It just stop parroting stupid, you know, just stop it and just recognize that when this is over, and it will be over, that you have to go on in a country and in communities across this country that are going to look at you like you are from a foreign planet, and they will have nothing to do with you as a party, because the grave you're digging will be so deep you can't get out of it. But, you know, Trump keeps giving them the shovel. They keep digging because they want to keep him happy. We want to keep
him
happy.
I mean, it is really amazing. And if you look at what happened, Michael, during the span of a week, I mean, the president went to to Europe, and he didn't go to the military cemetery because of rain. He then did not go across the bridge, basically a seven-minute drive to Arlington for Veterans Day. And then he attacked Admiral McRaven, a real American hero who directed the raid on Osama bin Laden.
Right.
And you have to wonder whether his support among service members, among the military, is going to continue. I
got to
think that those things are really going to drive his numbers down, and that was part of his base.
It's taking a hit. In fact, there was a poll that was out just recently that showed the numbers narrowing between support for and support against the president. That, you know, it was a wide gap. I mean, the military was, you know, good soldiers. They stood behind their commander in chief. But that now is kind of narrow, where I think the difference is something like 8 points as opposed to the 20-some points
Wow.
it was before. Yeah, it's narrowed considerably. So you make an excellent point about the impact it's going to have and is, I think, already having in his relationship with the military. Before we go, I do want to get to a little bit of policy with you. You wrote a piece which I thought actually you wrote it the day before my birthday, and it appeared on The Hill, thehill.com, where you talked about healthcare. So we'll talk a little bit of healthcare policy, but it was a very personal story for you, and I want to quote just real quick from it. You say, like many members of Congress, I thought I knew healthcare until I got sick. Just over a year ago, I shared my story about my personal fight for my right to health care while my former Republican colleagues were doing everything in their power to take it away. It's not a secret. I have multiple sclerosis and an autoimmune disease that attacks the central nervous system. It is a chronic and expensive disease. Millions of Americans have reached the break point, exhausted savings, unable to keep pace with expenses. You go on and cite, for example, your medication alone runs roughly $73,000 a year. An MRI scan costs you at about $29,000. And since you're now in the private market and no longer on the government health care plan as a member of Congress, you're looking at $1,600 a month with a $6,500 deductible. That's the reality and the truth for a lot of Americans, isn't it? And I think the heart of the healthcare debate for me, because I had my big issues with the way Obamacare, the ACA, was fashioned, largely around who was at the table fashioning the legislation. You weren't at that table. Your doctor was not at that table. The providers of medical devices weren't at that table. Who was at that table was insurance companies. The insurance companies were the only one at that table deciding and dividing up how healthcare would be done. From a policy standpoint, wouldn't it make sense to have a more holistic approach to this healthcare question, where all the interested parties and affected parties, starting with the patient, is in the room at the table with the legislators as they're crafting this, so they know from a real story like yours how to go about putting together the kind of health care that addresses market-based solutions at the same time keeping it affordable and reasonable for everyone to access?
Let me just say now, I mean, even though, you know, I outlined all of the tremendous costs with my my health care for treatment of multiple sclerosis, I am a fan of the Affordable Care Act.
Okay.
But I do think my experience tells me that there are some real gaps in there. And so, for example, now because I'm in the private market, I'm self-employed. I fall in the gap.
Yep, me too.
For the Affordable Care Act, right? And there are millions of people around the country. If you own a small business, you know, you're self-employed, you fall in that gap. Well, we've got to fix that, because we shouldn't have people who go to work and do work every day falling through a gap for healthcare. We didn't do anything with prescription drugs. I wanted to do something on prescription drugs. I actually was in the Congress at the time. I actually did have some provisions in there to kind of curb what insurance companies are doing, but we could do more. And I have to say, on prescription drugs, the drugs that I take in Europe and in Canada cost one-tenth of what it costs here in the United States. Same formulation, same drug, same manufacturer, one-tenth the cost.
Right.
And so I know there's something that we can do around prescription drugs. Ideally, to be honest with you, Michael, I would love to be able to buy into Medicare. And the reason is because even if I paid the full cost of buying myself into Medicare, it would be way cheaper than what I'm paying now. And so I think there's still more conversations that we need to have with healthcare. But I thought the importance and the value of this year and this healthcare discussion is opening up the door to the things that we need to do. Because even those of us who voted for the Affordable Care Act, and I did, I actually gaveled it in and out. I have the gavel. That I think that we recognized then that it wasn't perfect.
Right.
But then we came into a Republican Congress that basically either wanted to repeal it. The replace thing was never real.
Right.
It was just like repeal.
Well, that's been proven.
And,
that's been proven now.
Right.
In case anyone doubts what you just said, that's been proven.
That's right. And so we didn't even, we never had a chance to then go back to the table like you do with any other piece of legislation, major legislation, and go, okay, what did we miss? And then we could bring the people around the table who could help us figure out what it is that we missed. And so I think many of us would agree that there are other things that we can do around healthcare. And because it's such a consuming cost, I mean, if I continue like this, I'll be broke.
Yeah.
I'll be honest with you. I will be broke. And there are people who lose their homes and everything because they can't afford their healthcare costs. You go into senior living places and others, and people are cutting their medications in half because they can't afford their medication. This is not acceptable in the United States. I mean, it really just can't be acceptable. And my chronic illness isn't as expensive as some other ones, but it's doggone expensive.
Well, this point in your article, and again, folks, this was on thehill.com from October 18th of this year. If you want to take a look at Donna Edwards' story on this subject, you say $650 million a year is raised on GoFundMe to cover medical costs that insurance companies refuse to cover. And that, for me, still in this space of Obamacare, where we're in this never land with Republicans in terms of what their solution or would be, insurance companies still are in many cases driving the market space. There are a lot of people who are not getting the kind of coverage that they need. And now that steps have been taken inside the administration through executive order and proposed legislation to further weaken the ACA without taking into consideration the impact on pre-existing conditions and those types of giving insurance companies greater flexibility, Donna, to decide, well, you know what, we're just not going to cover that medication for your MS. That's where I have a problem with the current system. I don't want the government running and controlling healthcare. That's just a fundamental principle thing for me. I think we can make it better in the market space, but I also recognize what does work. So, and my buddy Rick Unger and I used to fight over this when we had Steele and Unger on SiriusXM, and I came around on this idea of a bifurcated system, which actually he was doing Medicare for all kind of a deal. Mm-hmm. And I was like, well, why don't we just do a parallel market space where those who want to go into a Medicare for all system can. So we create incentives for people to enter that market sooner as opposed to waiting at 65, maybe you go in at 50, right? So now you've got healthier people in that market space who are paying premiums. And then those who want to be in the private sector can do that. So let's shore that up. But their options, I guess, is my point. So to your last point, you don't wind up going bankrupt trying to keep yourself alive and healthy for your kids and your family.
Well, and you know, what's interesting about what you've just said is that, of course, in the original bill that went from the House over to the Senate for the Affordable Care Act, there was what was described as a public option. Mm-hmm. So if you wanted to, rather than go into this sort of insurance marketplace, you could choose to buy into Medicare.
Right.
And that was stripped out. That was stripped out of the House bill when it got over to the Senate. And when it came back, it passed without it.
Without it.
I think that we have to go back to that, because if I had a choice today, I would take, you know, literally a quarter of what I pay into an insurance plan now, and I would be able to buy into Medicare.
Yeah.
And why shouldn't I be able to do that? It's my money.
Right.
Why shouldn't I be able to do that?
Well, you sound like a Republican there. Yeah, I like that.
Well, okay. No. I mean, it is Medicare, Michael. It is Medicare.
Well, it's not just your money in that case. It's my money, too.
No, but I mean, you know, if I individually did that.
Oh, yeah,
right.
Yeah.
Now,
no,
I don't qualify for Medicare.
Yeah.
It's all my money,
of
right?
Of course. Yeah,
so that would be. And you would agree with that, right?
Yeah, yeah. No, I'm just having fun with you. I'm just having fun with you. Donna Edwards, the former congresswoman from the 4th Congressional District of Maryland, once my congresswoman and a very good friend. We have fun when we're on air together on MSNBC, which we get teamed up a lot more frequently, which I'm pleased to see. And it's a real pleasure having you come and tussle with the Man of Steel today.
Well, thank you very much. And I used to love saying one of my constituents is the chair of the RNC.
I bet you that went over well in some rooms, let me tell you.
Thank you so much.
Oh, no, thank you. Thank you. I appreciate you so much, Donna. You take care of yourself out there. And folks, don't forget, it's the holiday season, and we're all thinking about giving and sharing. Sometimes the best gift that you can give is an opportunity that could change someone's life. That's why our friends at Transatlantic Real Estate have created an investment opportunity for the everyday investor. Here's the deal. We all know that legal marijuana has created one of the fastest growing industries in this country. We also know that crowdfunding makes it easy to get in early on an investment opportunity. MarijuanaStock.org combines the two. They buy land that supports marijuana grow operations and leases it to licensed high-paying tenants, so you can invest in the landlord of a licensed marijuana farm in a high-growth market. Act now and you can participate for as little as $300 before the company goes public. Just go to MarijuanaStock.org to complete and confirm your application to participate. Don't just buy a gift this holiday season. Get an investment opportunity for someone special. To get started, go to MarijuanaStock.org. That's MarijuanaStock.org. You can find me on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn, or wherever you get those crazy, wacky podcasts, including the Man of Steel podcast. Check it out. Stay tuned for the next episode. You know we're coming back because we miss you and we love you so much. Take care.